The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the wave of Easter Sunday attacks in Sri Lanka, which killed 321 people now, including two Australians. The group, which has lost all the territory it once held in Iraq and Syria, has released images that purportedly show the attackers in the Easter Sunday attacks. The announcement came just hours after Sri Lanka's State Minister of Defence told the Parliament that these attacks were in retaliation for last month's Christchurch mosque bombings, which left 50 Muslims dead. Counter-terrorism experts have long warned that South and Southeast Asia are becoming the new breeding ground for radical Islamists. Kamran Bukhari is an expert on political Islam and violent extremism. He's head of the Centre for Global Policy in Washington, and he's a non-resident scholar with the Arabia Foundation. I spoke with him earlier from Washington, D.C.
Thank you for having me.
The Islamic State group is claiming responsibility for the attacks in Sri Lanka. They've made that claim via the Amaq news outlet. There's nothing offered to support the claim, but what do you think? Did these bombings have the characteristics of an ISIS attack?
Very much so. I know of no other organization that can pull off an attack of this magnitude. The death toll is, according to the reports, it's the highest if you take out the 9/11 attacks. And then if you look at the geography of attacks, if you look at the resources that were required to come in, and both human and material, the mobilization, the capability, the tradecraft, all of that points to ISIS. I know of no other organization that can do that on a transcontinental level.
In fact, this would be ISIS's major attack outside of Iraq and Syria, wouldn't it, by a long way?
Absolutely. And, if you look at the fact that there is no prior jihadist activity in the country, the Muslim population is like 7%. This is not a place where you would think that there could be a group that could just pull this off all by itself. It requires the wherewithal and the resources that only ISIS can muster up. And so, or at least we've seen in recent years. Prior to that, it was Al-Qaeda, but then we know that Al-Qaeda has been eclipsed by ISIS. So I have no doubt in my mind.
But why then? Why would it choose Sri Lanka?
A number of reasons, largely operational. First of all, these attacks are targets of opportunity.
A soft target, in a sense.
Not just a soft target. It's to go into a place that that law enforcement and international intelligence agencies are not expecting. And then, of course, you just can't walk into some place. There has to be a local conflict, a local grievance. Then you have to have local support, enablers, facilitators that you can shake hands with and then engage in this game of murder. So it's a lot of it logistical. It is a target of opportunity where you can actually pull it off. And it's a very sophisticated allocation of financial resources, because as we know, ISIS operates in many different countries across many multiple continents, and therefore it has to decide where it's going to go in and actually invest more so than other places. So it's a cost and benefit analysis that goes into the making of these kind of attacks.
Again, I suppose, why Sri Lanka? I mean, the government has identified a little known extremist outfit called the National Tawhid Jamaath, or NTJ. NTJ is not a particularly jihadist juggernaut. It's mostly known for defacing Buddhist statues. But you're saying that it would somehow become entrenched with Islamic State?
Absolutely. Think about it. If you have been engaged in vigilantism and vandalism, and that's the high mark of a group's activity, as is the case with this local Sri Lankan Islamist group, then how does that group go from doing that kind of very basic, form of violence to pulling off a sophisticated operation like that? They had to be trained. Their people had to go through conditioning, both mental and physical. They had to be, the bombs had to be made, the IEDs. And that's a tradecraft that requires skill set and transfer of technology.
It's estimated that only 32 Sri Lankans have fought with ISIS in Syria and Iraq, which is not a big number. But would you expect that that cohort would be a key link between National Tawhid Jamaat and ISIS? Is that somehow the bridge here, the key?
Yes. I mean, you need to have an entity in a country where if you're ISIS and you want to operate, so you need to have a local partner. Now, we've seen ISIS do both. We've seen ISIS accept volunteers to come and fight in Syria and Iraq and gain that experience. And they're used as cannon fodder in their fight to defend their territory. But at the same time, ISIS also sees value in the reverse, which is that you give these guys a bit of experience. They go back and, the big thing is, can they go back without being detected? I know that in Western countries, we all know that in Western countries, the security net or grid has gone up, and it's very difficult for foreign fighters returning to their home countries because they're on the radar of law enforcement and they're being monitored and watched out for. But in the case of Sri Lanka, we don't have the same mechanisms in place. So it's easier for the foreign fighters to go back and set up shop in country. So that's a separate, if you will, division of ISIS that engages in these transcontinental attacks.
You're listening to RN Breakfast. Our guest is Kamran Bukhari, an expert on political Islam and violent extremism. Sri Lanka's State Minister of Defence has claimed that the attacks were a response to the recent mass shooting of Muslims in Christchurch. No evidence, again, for this claim. In your view, is there likely to be a connection?
I seriously doubt it. I mean, attacks like these are not, ones that you can do on demand. Even if you are a very sophisticated group, even if you have many years of experience in a country and you've pulled off attacks in the past and your organization has grown, even then you just can't sort of turn around in that short time frame. For ISIS, the claim of responsibility, at least I've not seen them mention that this is in retaliation for Christchurch. And so they would be the first ones to go. And if that was the case, they would want to milk that for whatever it's worth. And therefore, they would have exploited that whole thing in their discourse. We haven't seen that. And then, of course, there is the physical, problems or the physical hurdles in turning around an attack so quickly. These kind of attacks, especially in a country where you have zero activity, at least zero attacks to show. So obviously, these people have been working under the radar for a very long time.
Can I just ask you finally, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, obviously both have their roots in the Middle East. Both have lost considerable power and support in Iraq, in Syria and Afghanistan. Some counterterrorism experts have described Southeast Asia as the second front for Islamic State. And I guess after this attack, we can include South Asia there as well. How vulnerable is this broader region given its porous border, poor enforcement measures and disenchantment among marginalized Muslims in some countries?
Well, I think you've put your finger on the crux of the problem. I mean, let's examine Southeast Asia. So you have a large Rohingya population that is susceptible to ISIS ideology because of their persecution, and then they're not really being taken care of in Bangladesh. The Myanmar situation is apparent to everybody. Then we have a pre-existing low-level insurgency in what is called the Muslim South of Thailand. We have a rising religious conservatism, ultra-conservatism, a Salafization of Indonesia. We have a rise in religious political activism in Malaysia. And these countries are not like Muslim majority in the sense that, the Middle East or even a country like Pakistan or Bangladesh is. There are large minorities. And therefore, they are being viewed by those who would want to do this kind of carnage as targets of opportunity. So my fear is that this broader region may see, an escalation in violence.
Kamran Bukhari, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kamran Bukhari heads the Center for Global Policy in Washington and is also a non-resident scholar with the Arabia Foundation.